I'm happy today to be here in the studio with Forrest Dunbar on the phone. He is on the ballot, the August 19th primary ballot, on the ballot for U.S. House on the Democratic ticket. Welcome, Forrest.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And I'm going to give you a little bit of background and remind our listeners of the background of how we've set up this particular format.
Sure.
Our general theme is how do you work with others? And the background to that, before we launch into the four questions we're going to deal with, is that both nationally and here in Alaska, there seems to have developed a more than usual political polarization that results in gridlock and and decisions made by use of power that isn't always backed by a majority of citizens. So we're going to do four questions. And the first one is kind of a general overview that starts by asking, how do you view the present state of government and how do you work with others of different perspectives, both within and without your party?
Well, again, thank you for having me on. And I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head when you were talking about political polarization a second ago. And how we got there is a really interesting question. But I'll just say personally, you know, I pride myself on being able to work in a bipartisan fashion, being able to work across the aisle. You know, I don't think we should treat the word compromise like a dirty word, and there are people that do so. My first job in politics, I worked for Frank Murkowski, just as a lowly intern, and of course, he was a Republican senator. And then later, when I was in college, I worked first as an intern, then as a paid staffer for a Democratic congresswoman. Last year, actually a year and a half ago, I did a little work alongside Fred Dyson, who was a very conservative state senator, as you know. And at the same time, around the same time, I was helping restart the Alaska Young Democrats. So, you know, I really think that it's important that you be willing to listen to ideas from both sides of the aisle, and that you, you know, approach things, you try to have some conception of the public interest rather than just your party's interest. Now, how we got there, I think a lot of it boils down to, there's a number of reasons why, but one of the key reasons that the policies we see are disconnected from what a lot of Americans want, a lot of Alaskans want, has to do with our campaign finance system. And the fact that because our representatives have spent so much time fundraising, they can be persuaded by lobbyists that can come to them and say, hey, I will raise X amount of money for you. You take it easy a little bit. And then you hear my side of the story. And there's a great book written by this about this recently by a law professor named Lawrence Lessig, sort of a libertarian law professor at Harvard. It's called Republic Lost. And so I really think if people are interested in how we got where we are today, that is one of those really key books. Again, it's called Republic Lost by Lawrence Lessig.
Okay. Well, thank you. Now, here in Alaska, there has been considerable focus on balancing resource development of extractive industries with environmental concerns. Now, what are your guiding principles when weighing in on this topic?
Well, you know, I consider myself a pro-development and pro-jobs Alaskan. And, you know, I worked as a commercial fisherman and a wildland firefighter, and I've been around a variety of different industries. And, you know, there's no question that oil and gas in particular is going to be the future of our state. It's the present of our state. It's the future of our state to a certain degree. That being said, I have been talking a lot on the campaign trail about diversifying our economy. And, you know, I think Bill Walker talks a lot about having value added, that we shouldn't just be exporting raw materials. We should try to turn them into something before we export them. And that's not always feasible, but in some cases it is. And I care a lot about things like sustainable fisheries, about alternative energy. And for me, it's not so much not environmentalist perspective as simply a dollars and cents, lowering the cost of energy, getting good jobs. And finally, also high tech. I think there's real potential. In fact, I know there's real potential in Alaska, particularly in the Anchorage Bowl, but all in Alaska, to develop a more robust high tech sector. And we're going to have fiber going live to the home in 2015 here in the Anchorage area. And we're hoping we can push some of that out into the rural areas as well. And that's going to allow for things like maker spaces. It's going to allow for young people to develop programs in their own home and in cooperatives. Now, that isn't going to provide all of our jobs. There's going to be a lot of jobs that are still going to be the traditional crafts, you know, the welders, the carpenters, the pipe fitters. And I'm very supportive of vocational education. And those will be more connected to the extractive industries. But to circle back to your original question, you know, I certainly think we want to protect the environment when it's feasible and when the environment truly is precious, and certainly when it threatens human well-being, as we saw with Flint Hills in North Pole. But in general, I think we should default to yes on a lot of projects. We should start by saying, you know, we can do this project, we want to do this project, and then see, is there a reason we can't do this project? And I think the best example of that is Pebble. You know, we'd like to see copper and gold be extracted. We'd like to see those mining jobs. But we know that Pebble is probably incompatible with the fishing industry we have out there, and the culture of fishing we have out there, for thousands of years of culture out there. And because of that, it's, in my opinion, and I think the science backs this up, resource, the fishing resource, the risk is too large to the fishing resource, and so we're going to stop Pebble in that instance. And I think that's the kind of weighing we have to do every time one of these projects comes up. We start by saying we hope to do this, we want to do this, and then we say, what are the risks? What industries is it going to impact? What culture is it going to impact? And is it going to impact the health of our citizens?
Okay. Well, swinging a little bit more far-reaching with a question, we'll move to number three. Edward J. Snowden's actions have led to a widespread discussion about another kind of balance between privacy and security. And there's an often overlooked aspect of the Snowden affair, and that's the role of media in reporting about or deferring to government activities. What are your guiding principles when weighing in on that topic?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, I don't want to be too topical, but we kind of see what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri right now, too. Where some people are upset with what the police may or may not have done, and the sort of show of police, basically military force, when the protests started, and it's brought these questions again to the forefront. And I think we're always trying to weigh again between security and civil liberty. Now, for me, I'm sort of again kind of a libertarian on these things, and I tend to lean towards towards personal liberty, towards civil liberty, towards privacy. And I think the majority of Americans feel that way as well. And, you know, I was in college from 02 to 06 in Washington, D.C., and me and a lot of my friends were protesting the Patriot Act. We were saying, this is wrong. This goes way too far. And I hope that, so right now we've seen a sort of rebirth of this idea on the right that the president is overreaching, that the government is overreaching, that they're snooping, all this stuff. I wish they had been standing with us back when the warrantless wiretaps were going on, back when we were protesting the Patriot Act, and instead they were saying that we were unpatriotic, you know. So I am a little bit suspect that some of them are just sort of taking shots at the president. But for those who are a little more genuine and who were protesting this stuff in the Bush administration as well, and who will hopefully continue protesting as I will, regardless of who the next president is, and saying, you know, we've gone too far. And we can't have these kind of inward-looking programs targeting Americans. Now, I'll say specifically about Snowden, you know, he revealed two main programs, and he some others too, but two main ones originally. And half of that was targeted at metadata of American cell phone users, and the other half was targeted at sort of Facebook and that kind of stuff for people outside the country. The second program I am more comfortable with. That is sort of what our security apparatus does, and that's probably expected. But scooping up a huge amount of data about innocent American citizens and assuming that at least some of them are going to be guilty, I think is counterproductive. So not only does it violate our Fourth Amendment rights and arguably our First Amendment rights, it also, you know, studies have shown that it also doesn't really work very well for counterterrorism or for law enforcement, because you end up with so much data that it's hugely difficult to sift through it all and find what we actually need. And so the Israelis, for example, who obviously take this stuff very seriously because their problems are more immediate, they don't take those same kind of approaches. And another example I'll give, I remember I actually went to Israel, I've been to Israel a couple times, and on my way home, I was passing through security at Israel, in Israel, on the way onto the plane, and I asked them, you know, do I need to take my shoes off? And they kind of gave me this quizzical look like, why would you take your shoes off? Like, we know if you're going to be a threat or not. We've got people evaluating you, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think that we haven't really approached it smartly here in America in a lot of cases. We've both intruded on people's personal privacy and created a heck of a lot of inconvenience for citizens. And I don't think it's actually appreciably increased our security very much.
Okay. This second part of that question involved the role of media. Extending it, because I think you've covered the first part well,
right.
And it's that question of, right. For example, the media in Washington, D.C. being subservient to the government, asking,
right.
you know, talking, et cetera.
I'll give it, you know, I think you're right, and people, you know, our Fourth Estate perhaps isn't what it once was, and we'd like to see it become a little more aggressive. I think investigative journalism, unfortunately, isn't as common as it once was. Part of that is because it's just sort of an economic reality. And especially as we get these sort of media conglomerates buying things up, we're going to see less of that. But I do know when we were moving into Iraq, and, you know, as you might know, I'm in the Alaska Army National Guard. I have a lot of friends who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I hugely respect the work that they did. But the lead up to that war, I think the discourse in D.C. and New York and in the nation was really, really shoddy, and it really did a disservice to the citizenry. And then even as we were moving into Iraq, the media sort of, I think, did bend over a little bit too much, bend over backwards a little bit too much to sort of accommodate the military and the government. And it's kind of funny because, you know, there's a chance that I might get deployed someday, and I'll probably be on the other side of it. But I do think, you know, there's an extreme example that happened recently. So there's a great article in the New Republic about Hamas and Hamas's media strategy. So there are all these journalists in the Gaza Strip while the Israelis were coming in to destroy the tunnels. And the journalists, after they left and after things kind of now have simmered down, came out and said, you know, Hamas told us, you will film this dead child. You will film XYZ. You will not film our guys shooting from these schools. You will not film our guys shooting from the UN shelter. And the journalists saw this stuff, but they said, if we reported on it, we would be killed or at the very least expelled, and we would lose all of our access. And so what you saw was, in much of the media coverage, a very one-sided sort of slanted view of what was happening. It made it seem like the Israelis were targeting civilians because you never saw right before that bomb hit, you didn't see that Hamas fighter firing that rocket. And that's, of course, an extreme example, and I don't think our government has gone nearly that far. But that kind of control of the media I find extremely worrisome, because when you have a one-sided view on any conflict, naturally the citizenry, you know, isn't able to make an appropriate decision, and it really short-circuits our democracy.
Okay, well, thank you. The last question, number four, the Supreme Court has recently taken stands that seem to put corporations above individuals, and in Alaska, that may be one aspect of the discussion of the role oil companies play in what has been referred to as our owner state. How do you view corporations?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's very topical. So I'm sitting actually in my office right now. I'm looking out onto just over Denali Avenue, and there's a giant neon one sign there. And I'm not sure what office building that is, but there's a big neon one sign. So it's literally right in my view.
Okay.
So, you know, it's been a very interesting sort of discourse. So it just came out today. The official numbers was about, the oil companies have spent about $13 million directly. Their employees have donated about another $1.6 million. That was as of a couple of days ago. You know, it's really, if you go online, you go on TV or you turn on the radio, it's everywhere. I think, you know, regardless of how you feel on Bond 1 or Yes on 1, regardless of how you feel on the amendment, I think we should be troubled by the idea that this kind of unlimited corporate cash can be spent and that it is equivalent to speech. So I signed something called the Alaska Constitution Pledge We the People Alaska Constitution Pledge. I signed it. Mark Fish signed it. Mark Begich signed it. Several of you might have signed it by now. I haven't gone back and looked again, but I know that my opponent, Don Young, has not signed it. And basically what it says is it's not even asking for it's just acknowledging the fact that in the Alaska Constitution in particular, these kind of constitutional rights were supposed to attach to individuals, to human beings. You know, human beings are the ones who have free speech rights. Human beings are the ones who have religious rights. You know, corporations, while they might be able to participate in some way, and the people in corporations be able to participate in democracy in some way, it really is an unoriginalist view of the Constitution, both the Alaska Constitution and the American Constitution. If you studied the history of the First Amendment at all, they weren't even conceiving of the fact that a massive corporation, I mean, first of all, corporations were sort of viewed in a much different light at our founding. But even beyond that, just the idea that they would have unfettered constitutional rights on the same level of as a human being, as an American citizen, is really kind of a remarkable idea, and again, totally out of step with what the original understanding of the Constitution was. And so, you know, some people have said we need to amend the Constitution. If that's what it takes, I would support that. But I think, frankly, all we need is we need first better Supreme Court justices, and then we would have the actual originalist understanding of the First Amendment, and we wouldn't have to worry about that so much. But secondly, there are statutes that we can put in place, and I have talked about this on the campaign trail, statutes that we can put in place that would help change the system a bit, even within the legal structure that the even within the legal structure the Supreme Court has created, there are still things that we could do that would help fix things and get us closer in the realm of political speech, get us closer to what we now have, the one-person, one-vote ideal.
Okay. Well, those were our four questions.
Okay.
And you've done a great job of covering them all. I want to thank you for running for public office.
No, it's my pleasure. And, you know, it's been an honor to travel the state. I just got back from Kenai yesterday. Last week we went to Haines, Sitka, Fairbanks, Ketchikan, not in that order, obviously. but it's been a tremendous honor, and I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I've been talking here with Forrest Dunbar, who's on the Democratic ballot for U.S. House. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.